Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a meeting Wednesday between Facebook's top executives and a group of conservative pundits and politicians that apparently was collegial and cordial, even though it was based on a completely made-up lie that Facebook was censoring conservative slanted news. One of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to everyday life, Toby Miller, joins us to discuss the successful right-wing strategy of inventing a left-wing bias, then moving the debate to the right by having conservative activists blackmail Facebook by threatening to boycott it, then getting Facebook to solve a non-existent problem by moving its news coverage to the right. We will also discuss the presence of Donald Trump's campaign coordinator and Facebook's sponsorship of Donald Trump's Republican convention in Cleveland. Then we look into the rightward shift by Israel's right-wing government of Prime Minister Netanyahu with a new coalition that makes the former bouncer from Moldova, Avigdor Liebman, Israel's new Minister of Defense, a post that has always been held by former military veterans, which Liebman is not, and the weakening of Israel's political opposition that is largely becoming irrelevant. Investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, the author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, joins us to discuss the tensions between Netanyahu's government and Israel's military over the execution of a Palestinian by an Israeli soldier that military officials deplore and right-wing politicians celebrate. Then finally, with the presidential races capturing most of the attention, we'll examine some other issues in this election and look into the marijuana legalization initiative on the California ballot in November that has mobilized a lot of opposition. Lee Fong, an investigative journalist with The Intercept, joins us to discuss his latest article at The Intercept, Police and Prison Guard Groups Fight Marijuana Legalization in California, and the extent to which the law enforcement lobby is afraid of losing the funds from the war on drugs that they have become hooked on. Before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the Ulysses Hammer Forum that I am moderating this coming Tuesday, May the 24th at 7:30 p.m., Populism, Past and Present. We'll have Georgetown University historian Michael Kazin, the author of The Populist Persuasion in American History. He'll be looking back on the roots of populism in the political DNA of the country. And we'll also have Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New America Foundation, talking about populism here on the left in this presidential race with Bernie Sanders and on the right with Donald Trump. Again, Populism Past and Present, Tuesday, May the 24th at 7:30 p.m., free and open to the public at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood. Join me. And joining us now is Toby Miller, a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University in the UK. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
It's great to be back with you, Ian.
And Toby, the meeting that took place at the Facebook headquarters in Menlo Park, California, 16 Republican pundits and politicians met with Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg and other top executives on Wednesday. And apparently they've come to some kind of an agreement. But the whole thing is so clearly transparent that, again, this shows you how much better organized the right-wingers are in this country about extorting media coverage. They create this myth of the liberal media, which then forces the mainstream media to move the goalposts to the right against an imaginary left-wing hegemony. And now you've got the same thing happening with Facebook. But what's relevant here is that Facebook apparently controls something like 40% of media access, or how people access the media through Facebook. About 40% of the people get their information via this Facebook conduit. That makes them infinitely more powerful than all of the television networks and New York Times combined.
Well, I think there are a couple of things here, Ian. One is that Facebook has evolved a new strategy in the last few months, such that rather than doing what it used to do, which was to link news stories on its site, it now actually becomes, in a certain sense, publisher of those stories. Instead of going to, say, the New York Times or CBS to read a particular story, you just read it on Facebook. You may not even realize that it comes from one of those sites. The other thing that's relevant is that Gizmodo, which is the technology gossip site that, in a sense, is the origin of this story, ran an account, what it calls, bizarrely, a report, a few days ago, in which it claimed that anonymous sources who were reactionary, Republican-affiliated contractors to Facebook disclosed their concern that the supposed decider of which stories get privileged as most popular on Facebook was in fact not the result of an algorithm and hence a simple independent verification of what people clicked on, but rather was curated mostly by liberals who preferred to see stories that came through the New York Times or NBC or CNN rather than Fox News. Now, what's relevant to that is in part, A, Facebook's desire to become a news organization, and D, in the case of Gizmodo, the fact that this is a scurrilous piece of reporting where no sources are named, where there is no other side given, and most of all, where it's in a sense not unreasonable. Because even though you and I may regard, for instance, CNN and the New York Times as really very reactionary, they do at least have a vast number of journalists around the world who go out and find stuff out, who do journalism. The problem with the supposedly conservative media in this country is that they are blowhards. They're places where opinion and fulmination occurs. They're not really places where there's a lot of first-hand reporting. So if this anonymous claim in Gizmodo is even accurate, then the claim itself seems to me to be describing something entirely reasonable, i.e., since Fox News doesn't have foreign affairs reporters, doesn't even have what we would regard as credible journalists, by contrast with, say, the New York Times or even the LA Times, then it's not unreasonable that there should be a certain curation of headlines that it produces. So I think those are a couple of the issues that are coming up to me. And another one, of course, is that, as you described, the conventional bourgeois media rolling over and just kicking its legs in the air in self-abnegation in response to right-wing critiques, this is a sign, A, of the fact that there's no spine for the tech sector, but B, of the fact that the supposed liberalism of Zuckerberg and other people behind Facebook and Twitter and other sites is in fact tissue thin. These people are not interested in class politics, they're not interested in race politics, they're not interested in gender politics, as their hiring practices and their attitudes to taxation clarify. They're vaguely liberal on things like sexuality and on immigration. But fundamentally, they're there to make money and to a certain extent to exercise power. And so on the one hand, they lack spine. On the other, they lack principle.
Well, Donald Trump's people were also amongst this team that showed up, you know, Barry Bennett, Trump's campaign coordinator, and also Peter Thiel, the libertarian Silicon Valley entrepreneur. He is a Facebook board member, and he's also a delegate for Donald Trump, and he was in amongst these people that attended. But again, just in terms of sort of tactics and kind of mau-mauing, as they used to say in the 60s, these characters on the right have pulled off quite a coup. As you point out, there was no substance to these charges in the first place, and Zuckerberg said that and made it clear, but that didn't stop them from pushing this meeting. And meanwhile, Facebook was losing a lot of Republican customers because of the propaganda. So Facebook had to deal with this, and now the goalposts will be moved to the right. They've succeeded. How come the liberals can't do that? What's wrong with them?
Well, I think that just as, of course, there are major splits within the Republican Party, and it's a coalition that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, so this is true of Democrats and other liberals. They're a coalition that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And, of course, liberals lack certitude. They lack the certainty that they're right, that a lot of Republicans do. One of the tragedies in all of this is that basically all the content analyses done by independent scholars and think tanks of news coverage shows that, if anything, there is a bias towards the right in the way in which the mainstream media cover political and economic stories. You've only got to look in particular at things like foreign policy when it comes to U.S. interests, when it comes to war-making and war-mongering, for that to be entirely evident. But that kind of scholarship is simply not reported adequately in the media most of the time here. So in a sense, not that I'm saying academics hold the truth all the time, but the scholarly findings that indicate the rightward bias of so much of the media have simply not been used adequately in these discussions. And you have proprietors and journalists running scared. You know, there is a very significant block of very progressive people in the United States, but contrary to claims about this being dominated by Hollywood and Silicon Alley and Silicon Valley, a lot of it comes from Latinos, African Americans, and other members of the working class who frequently hold extremely progressive views on all manner of things. And, of course, that set of progressive views is not held by people who are in real positions of power and are able to say to Zuckerberg, we want a meeting and we want it now.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. So given that the right wing have pulled off this coup with Facebook, we still should address, though, the main issue here, which is the idea that this Silicon Valley company, a leader in social media, has the kind of power it has as a gatekeeper for the media. Again, the idea that 40% of people get their information via this portal of Facebook, whether they're biased or not, is hardly the point. They have just too much influence.
Well, I think that's another issue, of course, related to this one. And as you say, a very important issue, because we don't have the codes of ethics that supposedly help to animate and self-regulate how journalists operate. We don't have a tradition of newsroom competence and lines of authority. We don't have a set of rules and regulations as per, say, the Federal Communications Commission or public broadcasting legislation that helps to regulate what these people do. So Facebook has neither the kind of proper professional self-regulation that the journalistic brotherhood and sisterhood has, nor does it have the external state-based regulation that the broadcast media do. And that absence of either a real heritage of professional journalism and of outside regulation, I think, is an issue. And in your case, Ian, you have both a long-standing training in journalism and its ethics that goes back, shall we say, a long way, and you also have, for better or worse, a Federal Communications Commission that helps to decide what you can and cannot say. So I think those things are simply not in place there. And that really is, I think, the big problem when you consider how significant a news source Facebook is becoming. It needs both a set of proper journalistic protocols of self-regulation, and it needs to be treated in exactly the same way as, for example, Fox or CBS are treated by the Federal Communications Commission.
And, of course, there's a broader economic issue at play here. You know, the New York Times, The Guardian, which has a huge, successful website, the actual producers of news, basically, these people like Facebook and Google, they're the ones that are making all the money off the labor of others. That's the part that's extraordinary, in that the mainstream media, like The New York Times and The Guardian, are struggling, even though they're the ones that have all the bureaus and produce all of the news. So,
well, that's true. There are two problems that they've got. One problem is that people aren't actually buying newspapers anymore. And the second is that advertisers are not so wedded and don't need to be so wedded to these portals like The Guardian or The New York Times as they used to do, as used to be the case. Plus, of course, nowadays, the means of establishing how many people are reading and for how long have become more and more sophisticated technologically. So the information that's available to advertisers is now relatively autonomous from the news outlets themselves and often provides rather alarming information. You know, if you look at, for instance, nightly news on ABC, CBS, NBC, the people watching it are your age and mine and upwards. They're not the age of, you know, your producer or much of the KPFK listenership, or people who are on Facebook. So there's also a generational divide coming to play here. There is an economic problem for a lot of these news outlets, and there is, in addition, a quality problem on behalf of the new platforms. And there is, to running through that, a libertarian streak that they still borrow from the Stuart Brand whole of catalogue element of new technology that goes back now almost 50 years, where the idea that information is free, information wants to be free, all these other shibboleths come along and allow them to plunder the frequently unpaid journalistic efforts of experts in order then to be able to sell the intelligence that they garner about the eyeball actions and finger-clicking actions of their customers. In other words, what they're doing is taking the work that real reporters do to provide information, and then what they sell is information about the race, class, gender, age, and consuming proclivities of Facebook and Twitter visitors. So they're doing a kind of private sector spying about the audience that takes the place of the traditional economic model of conventional media.
And again, just in terms of the canard that there's such a thing as a liberal media, these people that we're talking about, Zuckerberg and Peter Thiel and most of the Silicon Valley titans, are pretty much all libertarians, are they not? This is not a liberal enclave by any stretch of the imagination.
They're not conventional conservatives in that they don't want to regulate the family. They don't want to regulate private behavior, as they would call it. But they're also opposed to, in many cases, any kind of significant redistributive mechanism through the taxation system that means that the wealthy who've made their money from the workers need to give a lot of that money back to ordinary people. They like the idea of charity as something targeted and selected by them. They don't like the idea that there would be any kind of democratic and accountable means of deciding how their wealth is used. So they share with liberals opposition to the notion that your sexuality is the business of the state. Perhaps they share that too when it comes to things like the right to choose, but they don't share any of the notion of the necessity for an equitable redistribution of wealth across the society to make the kind of United States that perhaps briefly came into being in the late 60s, early 70s.
Well, just in closing, Toby Miller, it's worth noting that Facebook are going to be a sponsor of the Republican Party's July convention in Cleveland, which will, of course, be the Donald Trump convention. So there you have it.
It's a match made in heaven. So for those of you who love the Rust Belt, for those of you who want to be part of the struggle for Ohio, which will be important come the general election, for those of you who see a nexus between the right wing of the Republican Party, Donald Trump, and the anti-statist, anti-democratic qualities of Facebook and Twitter, this is indeed a kind of simultaneous orgasm. So enjoy it while you're there.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Toby Miller.
No problem.
And again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University in the UK. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking to the rightward shift by Israel's right-wing government of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, who is an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, and Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And his latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And it does appear that the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel has taken a very sharp turn to the right. Most of the commentators in Israel are saying that this move to make Avigdor Lieberman the defense minister has essentially, and forming a new coalition with his party, has essentially emasculated the opposition. But it's also breaking a longstanding tradition in Israel where defense ministers usually come out of the military. So what do you make of this move?
Well, I, in my 2013 book, Goliath, opened with an extensive profile of Avigdor Lieberman because I thought he was such a pivotal figure in Israeli politics and that his presence on the Israeli scene would define Israeli politics for years to come. And I think, having come under a lot of attack for that analysis and for basically forecasting a permanent right-wing coalition for as long as Israel is in occupying power, that analysis has been sort of vindicated today. Netanyahu did not take his government, his governing coalition to the right. It already was the most right-wing coalition in Israeli history, but he only had, I think, 61 seats in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, with Lieberman and his Yisrael Beiteinu party. Netanyahu expands his coalition to 67 seats and gives his right-wing coalition much more stability and has frozen out Isaac Herzog, the leader of the Labor Party, formerly the kind of co-leader of the Zionist Union. But I just want to make a few points about what this means. First of all, Avigdor Lieberman, who's seen as a leader of the Russian community, which is a very right-wing authoritarian bloc comprised of 1.5 million Jewish Israelis, many of whom have no connection to the Jewish religion, are very secular. Most came from the post-Soviet Union, had no idea that Palestinians would be in their new country, and define themselves and their national narrative through the military. And so they have a very militaristic anti-Arab outlook that Lieberman reflects. Lieberman came out of the Likud party, and he was kind of Netanyahu's Russian fixer. He established himself once the Russian community became politicized and became this right-wing bloc and started his own party. And he did so with no shortage of money and support from the Russian mafia, specifically someone named Michael Cherny, who could have been extradited for crimes committed in Russia and made his fortune during Russia's aluminum wars. He's also funded by an Austrian millionaire named Martin Schlaff, who worked in the same KGB office as Vladimir Putin in Dresden. And Avigdor Lieberman has close ties to the Putin regime and to the Russians, and he himself is a former bouncer from Moldova. As you mentioned, he has no military background or very... He repaired tanks in the military. He was basically a nobody. He gained his experience, his street credibility, doing things like, for example, beating up a 12-year-old boy in his settlement who had punched his son. And he got off for the crime of brutalizing this boy through connections to one of Netanyahu's fixers. So Lieberman really represents the street and not the military. What's happening right now in Israel with the military is interesting because the military is in charge of 4 million Palestinians. A soldier who comes from a working class family that's very right wing, named Elor Azaria, executed a Palestinian on video in Hebron several weeks ago and started a national furor. It wasn't clear how which side Netanyahu would come down on, but his defense minister, the person that Lieberman has replaced, Moshe Yaalon, who does come out of the military, who really reflects the military's viewpoint, condemned the execution, the videotaped execution. So did the chief of staff of the Israeli military, Gadi Eisenkot, and the deputy chief of staff of the Israeli military, Yair Golan, compared Israeli society to 1930s Germany in a speech on Holocaust Memorial Day. Netanyahu eventually came out against these figures, who want to maintain an orderly occupation because there seems to be no end to the occupation. And so what Netanyahu is doing by installing Lieberman is empowering what you could call the Jewish Israeli street. If you go out of North Tel Aviv and talk to most Jewish Israelis, they will side entirely with Elor Azaria, the soldier who executed this immobilized, unarmed Palestinian who is lying in a pool of blood and just blew his brains out. And they will support Lieberman, who is called for example, beheading disloyal Palestinian citizens of Israel. He's called for bombing the Aswan Dam in Egypt, which would possibly cause millions of casualties, along with a nuclear attack on Iran and the Gaza Strip. So Lieberman is this sort of populist figure who has his finger on the pulse of the real future of Jewish Israeli society, which is right wing and militaristic. And Netanyahu is using him as a lever against the generals who he sees as his primary opponents within the government.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, and Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And his latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. So this sets Israel up for a major battle, it would seem, between the military establishment, which has always been held in high regard, and this new right-wing government that's made even more right-wing by having Avigdor Lieberman as the defense minister. The battles that you're talking about between the generals and Netanyahu have intensified, particularly over the shooting, the execution of the Palestinian, but also, as you mentioned, the speech that was made by this senior general and infuriated Netanyahu when he compared the atmosphere in Israel to Nazi-era Germany. And, of course, the outgoing defense minister, Yalon, also spoke recently at a youth seminar in Tel Aviv talking about a loss of a moral compass in Israeli society. So do you see this then as a kind of watershed moment in terms of a kind of questioning of the very moral foundation of the country?
I think the watershed moment was Netanyahu's re-election and his last-minute racist appeal about buses full of Arabs. That's when Netanyahu really consolidated the dominance of the right wing and the permanence of the occupation. So this is just part of a progression into what could be kind of a terminal phase in this permanent occupying power that Israel's become. One thing I would point to, though, that really stands out to me, one event, is the rally in support of Elor Azaria, the soldier who executed the immobilized Palestinian in Hebron. It took place in Rabin Square, Kikar Rabin, in North Tel Aviv, which is the site of Yitzhak Rabin's assassination, the former Israeli prime minister, who really was the face of the old Labor Party military establishment, and who was assassinated by someone who was a disciple of the right-wing, ultra-right-wing religious nationalist rabbi in the settlement in Hebron, Dov Lior. Leah Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin's widow, blamed Netanyahu and his rhetoric for inciting the killing of Rabin. And so I saw this rally where thousands of working class Jewish Israelis chanted death to Arabs in Rabin Square as kind of dancing on Rabin's grave, dancing on the grave of the peace process and the two-state solution, and embracing a kind of militaristic apartheid future. The other factor in this is that the Zionist Union was supposed to uphold the banner of the opposition against Netanyahu. The Zionist Union was led by Isaac Herzog of the Labor Party and Tzipi Livni, who's a figure who's bounced around between parties. But Tzipi Livni comes out of the Likud party just like Avigdor Lieberman. And now the opposition has fractured and it's whittled down to Isaac Herzog, who's a very uncharismatic figure who in many ways has embraced Netanyahu's agenda, particularly for the Palestinians. He's put forward what he calls his separation plan. And in his words, his agenda is to get rid of as many Palestinians in as quick a time as possible with this plan, which calls for extending the wall into the West Bank and bringing as many settlements as possible into a future, into Israel's future borders. Israel currently has no borders. So the opposition is sort of actually a shadow of Netanyahu's Likud, and it was partially run by someone who comes out of Likud. So the point is, Israel is a one-party state, and there is no actual opposition. The dissent in Israel is really carried out by a few hundred radical leftists who are targeted, and who are actually targeted by legislation passing through the Knesset, which seeks to criminalize their speech. We published at Alternet, the magazine I edit, an article about one of the most hated people in Israel right now, who is an artist named Natalie Vaxberg Cohen. She's a performance artist who ridicules the government, and satirizes the militaristic atmosphere in her country. She's been arrested 5 times for her art. She's been jailed for her artistic performances. And that is the atmosphere that Deputy Chief of Staff Yair Golan referred to when he made this comparison to 1930s Germany. And that atmosphere will continue to intensify.
So in terms, though, of American politics, particularly with this extraordinary election season where, you know, you talk about Avigdor Lieberman being an authoritarian figure in Israel. Well, we have an authoritarian figure running for president of the United States in Donald Trump. And Adelson, the casino owner, has just pledged him a lot of money. My understanding is that Trump has always relied upon mysterious forms of financing to build his buildings and to keep his sort of Ponzi scheme alive, and that some of this funding has come from these same people that you're talking about, the Russian mafia types, because Israel has been, for the longest time, the number one money laundering country in the world in terms of Transparency International's keeping track of the money laundering countries. They've been the worst example for some time. Do you know of a connection between Michael Cherney and Martin Schlaff and Donald Trump?
I don't know about any connection there, but here's a clear connection. Trump owns casinos. Adelson owns casinos. They're both businessmen with a lot of shady connections. And Sheldon Adelson recently spent several days in a Las Vegas courtroom defending his casino empire against accusations of bribery and ties to the Chinese mafia, accusations that his casinos in Macau had been laundering money for a Chinese drug lord or the Chinese triad. In addition, there are reports that Adelson has laundered money for Mexican narco cartels. If this is true, and by the way, the Chinese triad I referred to is the Wo Hop To triad. If this is true and he is contributing money to Donald Trump's campaign, then Donald Trump is connected to Chinese triads and Mexican narco traffickers. And Adelson imagines that in a Trump administration, the Justice Department will drop these charges against him. So I think whatever Adelson thinks about Israel, Adelson is, of course, one of Netanyahu's key financial benefactors and controls a substantial portion of the Israeli economy. Whatever he thinks about that, his own business interests come first.
Well, it's obvious that Trump, as a president, would be sort of the head of the global authoritarian club that would include Putin and Erdogan in Turkey, Lieberman in Israel. And Lieberman, as you pointed out, through his connections to Martin Schlaff, has some kind of connection with Putin. I understand the role, the political role that he played, because all those Russians that came out to Israel during the Soviet era, of course, were predisposed to hate communism and hate the political left, and they were largely organized. by Likud, and that's how Lieberman rose to political importance. But apart from the stuff that you mentioned, wanting to bomb the Aswan Dam and deport all of the Israeli Arabs into the Palestinian territories, Lieberman also lives on the West Bank, and that's been, of course, a major thorn in the side of U.S. relations with Israel and Israel's relations with pretty much the rest of the world. And, of course, there is, I think back in 1970, there were about 10,000 settlers. Now there's close to 800,000. So here he is as a prime example of the settler movement, is he not, Lieberman?
Lieberman is not a prime example of what we would think of as the typical ideological settler. He lives in a settlement called Nokdim, which is easily accessible to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv through what are known as access roads. And they're basically, in many ways, are Jews-only roads. They're kind of like these super highways for Israelis, and you just speed by Palestinian villages and don't see anyone. So you don't even notice that you're in a settlement. Nokdim is not a very particularly religious settlement. When you think of the settlers, you're thinking of Kiryat Arba, which is just this kind of fascistic fever swamp that's implanted itself in the middle of a core Palestinian city, and it has to be protected by 1,500 Israeli troops at all time. And they stage, its residents stage kind of vigilante terror attacks against Palestinian farmers. Lieberman is secular. He doesn't believe in God, but he believes God gave him the land, which is the same perspective Netanyahu upholds. Netanyahu is not religious. But Lieberman understands the value of a coalition with the settlers. And so the Russians are a right-wing bloc that maybe has a different perspective than the settlers. They want civil marriage. Some of them have attempted to open churches in Israel. Some Russian Israeli youth have staged neo-Nazi hate crime attacks on Jews in Israel and distribute neo-Nazi literature from Russia. So this is very different than the world of the Jewish settlers who wear, you know, wool knit kippahs and stage price tag attacks. But there are many shared common interests with respect to the Palestinians. And that's where the Jewish Home Party, Habayit Yehudi, comes in. And this is the party of Naftali Bennett. Bennett is a coalition partner who runs the education ministry and the Ministry of Justice through his junior his kind of deputy, Ayelet Shaked. Bennett is in his 40s. Shaked is like my age. He's in her late 30s. Shaked called for a genocide, extermination of Palestinian mothers during Israel's assault on Gaza in 2014. She said that this needs to happen to prevent them from giving birth to, in her words, little snakes. And Bennett has said similar things. He said, "I've killed lots of Arabs, and that's not a bad thing." But Bennett is representing the religious nationalist public along with Shaked, and they really have their finger on the pulse of Jewish Israeli youth who are far more religious than their parents, far more right-wing according to every opinion poll, and much more inclined towards racist attitudes against Palestinians. And once again, Naftali Bennett came out of the Likud party to form Jewish Home and was a former deputy, just like Lieberman was a former deputy to Netanyahu. So it's still a one-party state.
Well, of course, and the point of this new coalition is that Netanyahu was hanging by a thread with a one vote majority in the Knesset. Now he has about a 7-vote majority. So just in closing then, does this mean for all intents and purposes the Israeli left is dead and buried, and so is the peace movement?
Well, you know, the Israeli left was dying when Rabin was assassinated, and the peace movement it depends on how you spell peace, because whatever's left of the Labor Party seems to support Netanyahu's agenda of stealing peace after peace after peace from the Palestinians. Just take a look at the Labor Party leader Isaac Herzog's separation plan. I think Americans need to recognize there is no hope for change from within Jewish Israeli society, for a movement towards a viable Palestinian state or peace with the Palestinians or justice for Palestinians. And that's why so many people who are concerned about this issue from a humanistic perspective are turning towards the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement because it actually gives them something they can do to apply pressure on Israel from the outside so that it will conform to international law. And it's really troubling to see state legislatures in the U.S. introduce laws that are moving towards the criminalization of BDS. I mean, we've talked about Donald Trump, but Hillary Clinton supports the legal suppression of the boycott movement, which means the suppression of the free speech of American citizens. And her presidency will be no worse, no better, and possibly worse than Donald Trump's for the 4 million Palestinians who live under Israeli occupation.
Right, but Donald Trump's presidency would be a catastrophe for America and the world. I can't see any comparison there.
Well, I think the reason that many neoconservatives and right-wing supporters of Israel are troubled about a Trump presidency is that he would pull America back. And if he fulfilled your warning, that would also be bad for Israel, which depends entirely on its direct line to Washington and on the $4 billion of aid it receives every year, which Barack Obama just increased. It's unclear what Trump will mean for U.S. policy in the Middle East, but it's very clear where Hillary Clinton stands, and she has her own personal Sheldon Adelson. His name is Haim Saban. He's someone based right near you in L.A., and he also controls a substantial percentage of the Israeli economy and is very close to Netanyahu and has contributed millions to pro-Hillary Clinton super PACs. Hillary Clinton has pledged to attack the BDS movement in a letter to Haim Saban. And Saban recently affected elections near where I'm speaking to you from in Washington, D.C., ousting Donna Edwards or preventing Donna Edwards from becoming what would have been the second African-American woman in the Senate and electing a more pro-Israel candidate, Chris Van Hollen. So Hillary has her own Adelson, and she's going to receive a lot of backing, I think, from the financial backers of Rubio and Jeb Bush, who are more hawkish on the Middle East.
Well, again, I think the proportionality is that it may not seem like it, but Israel is not the center of the world. There's a lot of...
No, I mean, I'm not making an argument for Donald Trump to be president. I'm just...
Oh, well, good. Let's end on that very clear note then, okay?
Well, let's just end with a recent development, which is that Trump is trying to make peace with the pro-Israel lobby in coordination with Sheldon Adelson, and has said that he has called upon Israel to build more settlements. So the future looks bleak for that part of the world, no matter who becomes president. And obviously, there are clear domestic differences.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Max Blumenthal.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times best-selling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, and Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And his latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining some other issues in this election, short of the presidential races. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lee Fong, who's an investigative journalist with The Intercept, who was the first to uncover and detail the role of the billionaire Koch brothers in financing the Tea Party movement. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. And his latest article at The Intercept is Police and Prison Guard Groups Fight Marijuana Legalization in California. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lee Fong.
Hey, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And Lee, just before we get to some of the stuff that you've been covering, because you're covering, we've been talking so much about the presidential races lately that we forget that there are other important ballot initiatives going on around the country. But just in terms of today's news, where Hillary Clinton, in an interview on CNN, basically said, look, I've already won the nomination. And then in terms of Trump, she turned her guns on Trump and said that he's dangerous and unqualified. Hardly news to most people, but it's certainly getting a lot of attention. How does that strike you on both counts? One, that declaring victory in California, and two, basically singling out Trump as being dangerous and unqualified.
I don't think there's any surprise that Hillary Clinton wants it change direction and focus on the general election. She's kind of done with debating with Bernie Sanders. She's been very reluctant to participate in any future Democratic primary debates. And although one could argue, of course, that looking at the number of pledged delegates, it's very, very, very difficult for Bernie Sanders to catch up. That being said, if you look at just 8 years ago, and during the 2008 campaign, at this point in May, Hillary Clinton, in her bid against Barack Obama, was pledging to stay in the race, through June, and that her surrogates, the co-chairs of her campaign, were going on television saying that the superdelegates should decide and throw the race to her no matter what happened. So, you know, it's funny to see these things play out in reverse all over again. Recent history is just kind of making its way back into the news. But, you know, for Bernie Sanders supporters, of course, they're not very happy about seeing these type of announcements, seeing Hillary Clinton kind of demand an end to the Democratic primary. And I think Bernie Sanders is going to keep demanding a real and robust campaign.
But in terms of a strategy, I wonder who's advising Hillary Clinton, because recently she said, I can't wait to debate Donald Trump. She was sort of gleefully rubbing her hands and did a very poor imitation of him. And this was at a time when the Republicans are questioning his legitimacy as a leader of their party, with Mitt Romney leading this effort to find an alternative. So here you have this extraordinary situation where the Republicans are questioning the legitimacy of Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton's giving him legitimacy by saying, you know, he's going to be my opponent. In other words, he's going to be an equal on the stage. Isn't this the time to delegitimize this guy?
Well, if you looked at the recent news from the Democratic Party, which is very close, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, with the Hillary campaign and the Hillary super PACs, you know, they've already been attacking Donald Trump for some time now. They want to run against Donald Trump. They don't want to run against Paul Ryan or any of these other kind of dream candidates. And they've got their strategy already kind of they're sending smoke signals about the way they want to run this race. You know, they're calling him Dangerous Donald. And, you know, there's a campaign that launched earlier this week kind of highlighting some of his more sexist comments. So they're very eager to engage Donald directly and cast him as way too extreme for America. But, you know, we've seen a lot of similar attacks tried on Donald Trump in the past in the Republican primary, and most of them didn't work. Almost carbon copies of the same strategy. I mean, the ad that's being run by the Hillary Super PAC this week looks a lot like the anti-Trump ad run by the Republican Super PACs back in the earlier part of this campaign. back in South Carolina. So, but again, that's a different part of the electorate. That's the Republican primary. Now we're moving to the general, where Democrats and independents will have a say. So, you know, we'll see if this is an effective tack for her.
Well, you would think that given how Trump has alarmed so many people, it would be a slam dunk. But I'm not entirely convinced that that Trump can't make it. And I'm not sure that that there's a lot of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, and the Bernie Sanders people have been citing polls saying that their candidate would do so much better against Donald Trump. Before we get to the other issues that you've been writing about, let me get a comment on you about that, if I could, Lee.
Well, look, we've had the last 6 or so years with basically no reforms from the federal level. You know, we had healthcare reform in 2010, Dodd-Frank also that year. We've basically had 6 years of political stagnation, and that 6 years followed, you know, the complete financial and housing crisis that wiped away so much wealth in this country. So people, I think, if you look at the electorate, if you look at what a lot of people are telling pollsters, they do want an outsider. They do think both political parties are corrupt. They think a lot of the big establishments, not just the political establishment, but even the media establishment, the big cable news companies, that they are irreconcilably corrupt, that there's a deep flaw in the system. So there is kind of this demand for an outside candidate who's outside the system, who's tough-talking, who calls it as they see it. And Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, in some respects, really kind of filled that void very well. And Hillary Clinton, one could argue that she personifies a lot of the problems of the old system. So while Donald Trump is very extreme, he has lots of skeletons in the closet, you could make the case that Hillary Clinton really understands policy and politics much better than he does. Given the kind of political environment for this year, and if you just look at the recent polls, I think it's going to be a really tough race for her.
And again, I'm speaking with Lee Fong, who's an investigative journalist with The Intercept, who's been the first to uncover in detail the role of the billionaire Koch brothers in financing the Tea Party movement. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and his latest article at The Intercept is Police and Prison Guard Groups Fight Marijuana Legalization in California. So let's turn to marijuana legalization in California in terms of essentially borrowing from the model already in Colorado. And it's on the ballot, though, but it's on the ballot in November. I imagine Bernie Sanders is kind of sorry it's not on the ballot on June the 7th.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Bernie Sanders has, I mean, one of his many issues that I think speak to younger generations, but he is very openly in favor of marijuana legalization. You know, he said at a campaign rally this week that If he was a California resident, he would vote for marijuana legalization in California. He said that also in Nevada, where they also have marijuana legalization on the ballot this November. It's in almost half a dozen states this year. And it's a big issue, but unfortunately, it's not really, there's not much to suggest that the ballot initiative would directly benefit his campaign, because again, the Democratic primary is this June, and voters will decide on the initiative this November.
So in terms of then who's against this initiative, and it would seem to me a pretty uphill battle to defeat it, but a lot of resources are being poured in, and you reveal in your piece at The Intercept, Lee Fong, that police and prison guards are a big part of it. There's also, of course, former Representative Patrick Kennedy, a Democrat of Rhode Island, and former George W. Bush speechwriter David Frum also have a group called SAM Action, an anti-marijuana advocacy group. So give us a sense of how the forces against it are going to wage a campaign and how convincing their arguments are going to be.
Well, police have really, and law enforcement have really led this effort. There are other donors, some ideological forces and some advocacy groups, but really police have taken center stage. And the way that they have won on marijuana for many years is not that they can raise more money. They do use police professional associations and labor unions to raise a little bit of money. But the way that they kind of leverage their political power is that police unions have a lot of sway in Democratic politics. They're also very good at getting media attention. So when cops go on television media or they appear in TV ads, it's a very convincing case to many people that they say that, you know, marijuana legalization will spread addiction in society. It will get teens addicted to marijuana, that marijuana will have lots of unintended consequences, like people driving under the influence. This is the kind of standard playbook and the rhetoric that's been used to campaign against marijuana reforms. We saw that in the last midterm election. Police led the way in defeating medical marijuana in Florida in 2014. And in 2010, almost an identical legalization, recreational marijuana ballot measure was in California. And it looked like it was doing pretty well, but towards the end of the final few weeks before the election, the anti-forces really mobilized a strong media effort and were able to sink the initiative. This year could be pretty different, though, because although that you see a similar coalition coming together, you see the similar rhetoric about the dangers of marijuana being employed, the pro-marijuana forces are much more organized. We've seen public opinion polls show much more support for the initiative. And for advocates of legalization, they can point to the success of states like Colorado that have legalized marijuana, brought in a lot of revenue for those states, brought in a lot of marijuana tourism, and we've actually seen less criminalization, less people being sent to jail, less people being arrested, and actually less people driving under the influence. And there are some studies that show that people are opting to drink less alcohol, to go out, and we're seeing less people being arrested and getting in accidents related to driving under the influence, because one would assume they're just sitting at home or going to their friend's house to smoke pot.
Well, Li Feng, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Hey, Ian, thank you so much.
And again, I'll be speaking with Li Feng, who's an investor journalist with The Intercept, who was the first to uncover and detail the role of the billionaire Koch brothers in financing the Tea Party movement. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. And his latest article at The Intercept is Police and Prison Guard Groups Fight Marijuana Legalization in California. Well, thanks a lot. It'll be at ianmasters.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.